was music from Gail Salmon, Nothing Gold Can Stay. 14 minutes after the hour, it is a Wednesday morning, and we are delighted to welcome back Doug Greenwald. Doug's been on a trip to Italy, a tour. He guided the tour. It's another one of, well, we call them Pauline Studies Tour, because that's what he does. And the first trip was back in May. Just returned from the second trip. I'm anxious to find out what he found out. Doug is the Senior Teaching Fellow and Executive Director of Preserving Bible Times. And we are privileged to have him alongside here just about every Wednesday morning. But missed you for a couple of weeks. So how'd the trip go? And the big question is, you know, we discussed the first trip many times, and we're really awed by what you brought back in terms of the context that Paul was working in as he wrote his epistles and managed and brought along his, nurtured his churches back then. I'm wondering if this trip modified in any way the views you brought home the first time. What say you?
Well, I think the word I would choose would be expansive or expanded. Mm-hmm. If you ever took high school chemistry and you did what we did back in those days, there was a time when you put a whole lot of sugar in a beaker and with room temperature water, and not much of it went into solution. And so you put the Bunsen burner underneath this beaker, and you heat it up, and then you stir it. And the hotter the water becomes, the more saturation it can absorb from the sugar, and eventually all of the sugar goes into solution. Mm-hmm. Then you remove the Bunsen burner and let this thing cool back down for several hours, undisturbed, without touching it, shaking it, or anything else. And once it gets back to a room temperature, you take just a little grain of sugar and you drop it on the surface of this now cooled, supersaturated solution, and instantaneously the whole thing becomes a crystal. Did you ever do that test?
No. I'm going to try it this afternoon, though.
Wow.
That's it. Yeah, and so that's the image that I have for this second study program we did. It's like things are really starting to crystallize for me in different ways at different levels. One of the changes that I made between the May trip and this October trip was I discovered some books on the rise of early Christianity. One of them by Roland Stark is a particularly good one. And I got fascinated, and this was the rise of early Christianity from 50 AD to 350 AD in the Roman Empire. And I just saw all sorts of linkages between the ground level context we were observing and the implications at 5,000 feet here for not only Paul's writings, but for the development of early Christianity. And so I think the teaching was more robust and integrative this time, and I found that absolutely thrilling. And I'm going to do some more work on the rise of early Christianity because I'm fascinated by the dynamics of that. But that plus perfect weather, we had rain for 1 hour, and that's while we were having lunch in 10 days. Great chemistry with the group. We had made some adjustments on sites and times we visit sites that made the trip more efficient and optimized it a little bit better. And I just came home with just all kinds of thoughts. And one of the things I'm going to do now, you're familiar with my monthly contextual reflection on a passage.
Oh, yes. That's his monthly newsletter, by the way. Comes by email. It's free. Anybody can subscribe to it at preservingbibletimes.org. I just wanted to throw that in there. You'll look forward to it every month.
Yeah, and at the two-week interval in between that, I'm going to start a second newsletter series. It's going to be on the MailChimp platform. They'll be much briefer, and they'll have many more pictures in it. I'm going to call this Glimpses into Paul's Roman World, and I've got 20, 25 subjects already down on a piece of paper here to start populating that particular brief, much briefer contextual insight, together with at least two pictures to go with every theme. I did a lot of catch-up photography on this trip as well, the things I missed or wished I would have taken the first time around. So I've got a pretty good visual library now to illustrate all these contextual insights into Paul's Roman world. And I'm juiced over that.
Well, I'll bet you are. I'll bet you are. How many people were in the group this time?
We had 22 in this group, okay. Which was very efficient. We got to manageable. Know each other very, very mm-hmm. quickly. It's an easier group to keep track of when you get into big cities like Rome or the Vatican. And but the nice thing about it is all the chemistries really worked well. And so it was a very enjoyable trip as well as a great learning experience.
Well, I love the description because not only do you learn a lot, but I mean things like the food and the quartering. You know, where you stay, the hotels or inns, all sounds like just a gorgeous kind of trip. And the weather, I guess, was perfect.
Oh, it was between 75 and 80 every day. Mm-hmm. Sunny. Mm-hmm. Unlike Israel, you have a lot of shade in Italy. So, you know, it just made for a delightful experience.
Now, tell us what geography does this tour cover? Because I know it's not huge. It's not hundreds of miles.
Yeah, we start outside of Rome at a place called Ostia Antica. It's ancient Rome. It's the port of Rome in the first century. And there we get a look at an industrialized city in the Roman Empire. And then we start working our way down the coast. We spend the first night at Manzio Appio, at a Mansione, literally on the Appian Way. Have a wonderful Roman meal. And we work our way down the coast. We see Tiberius's seaside villa. We go to the Sirens of Cumae, which are reflected in part of the Sistine Chapel, which is one reason we go there. We go to Minturno, where we literally walk on the Appian Way and understand the market and the slave systems. Then we work our way down to Puteoli, where in Acts 28, Paul lands on the Italian peninsula. And then we work our way down to Sorrento, and we spend a day on Capri. And then we start working our way back up to Herculaneum and Pompeii, the Naples Historical Museum, some of the seaside villas of the ultra-rich, which gives us some great insight into early Roman culture. We make a stop in Monte Cassino. Remember that name?
From World War II. Yes.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. St. Benedict's Abbey. Just an absolutely gorgeous site. Oh my goodness, completely rebuilt from the war. And then we spend 3 days in Rome. I mean, doing some of the usual things, the Colosseum and the Forum and the Vatican, but also dropping in things like where Michelangelo's last project was for the Emperor Domitian in 299 AD, where he took the Roman baths from the Domitian era and converted it into a basilica, which is just a huge surprise. Mm-hmm. We go outside the walls to the catacombs. We go outside the walls to the Abbey of the Three Fountains, where Paul was beheaded. We visit the grave of Paul at the Basilica of St. Paul outside the walls. We go to San Riglio, which is in the Jewish ghetto in the first century, where there's all kind of that significant evidence that this is where Paul was in house arrest. And we go down into the basement to those original rooms and just stand there and try to envision being with Paul and doing some reflective time there. So we do a lot of things. We'll do a lot more as well. But those are some of the main highlights just to give you a feel.
And how long does this take? Week?
It's a 10-day trip.
10 days. Okay.
And the food. Oh, it's so much. I want to say, yeah, it's different to be sure, but even better than Israel. Mm-hmm. Every lunch is a treat, whereas in Israel it's always falafel or it's always schnitzel or it's always shawarma. You know, those are your three choices no matter what the lunch is. And we were on a bus one day, and we have local tour guides who are expert in certain cities, and our Napoli guide was Teresa, a little short dynamite of a gal. And as we were riding around between sites, I said, "Teresa, what makes Neapolitan pizza so great?" And oh boy, did we get a lecture on Neapolitan pizza. You know, the reason I raised that is because 3 or 4 months ago, I'm at my daughter's house, and the Washingtonian magazine is on the cocktail table, and I pick it up, and one of the feature articles is about Neapolitan pizza comes to Bethesda, Maryland. And the whole article is about what a great pizza this is, and you have to go to California and spend $2,500 to learn how to make these pizzas, and you got to spend $15,000 for an oven that's always over 900 degrees because the pizza can only be 12 inches round. It can only be in the oven for 90 seconds, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. I mean, Neapolitan pizza is sort of becoming a subcult rage here in the United States. And there we are in Naples, the epicenter of Neapolitan pizza. So I asked Teresa, what makes it so special? And she says, oh, it's the tomato sauce. The lava remains from Mount Vesuvius eruption in 79 AD has created a very fertile soil, and it creates a tomato that's not too sweet and not too sour. It's just perfectly
San Marzano tomatoes.
And the same geological formation which has created the soil there creates a certain kind of grass that the cows eat, and the buffalo mozzarella is like nothing else in the world. And when the mozzarella, the buffalo mozzarella, and the tomato sauce comes together in our super hot ovens, it is the best pizza in the world. And so I had at least three Neapolitan pizzas for lunch on our trip.
Sounds pretty special. I have a question for you, though, because you are so enthusiastic about the results of these now two Italian trips and the context of the Roman Empire in Paul's time and its effect on the development of the church. How does this make the Hebrew context seem to you in your mind? Has it become a sidebar? Is it the foundation? What's the relation between the two now in terms of the development of the Western Church? Which was more significant, or the equal?
Well, you're going to see that in my very first Pauline reflection called Glimpses in the Paul's Roman World. What just hits you over the head once everything starts to crystallize, this is a completely different world than Judea and Samaria and Galilee in the first century. I mean, completely different. With Jesus, we're primarily in first century Jewish, observant Jewish villages and towns with a rural agrarian emphasis. I mean, he does go to Jerusalem, you know, every once in a while for a major festival, but the vast majority of his ministry is spent in the countryside. When you enter the world of Paul, you enter the world of urban Christianity. It's Christianity in the cities. And so all the language, all the visuals that Jesus uses don't work in the city. It's a different lexicon. It's different images. It's different words. They have different issues. They have a different mindset. And so, you know, I'm fairly comfortable with the context of the gospel period, having worked in it for 10 or 15 years pretty intensively. And it just dawned on me a year or so ago, I was almost a blank slate when it came to the Roman Empire and the Roman culture. And
I think most of us are.
And city Christianity in the first century. And so it is like writing on a blank blackboard for me, a blank whiteboard, and I've been trying to fill it up as fast as possible, and as soon as I fill things up, I can't wait to share it, and that's what we've been doing. But you would be stunned the different things you learn, the different ways you end up thinking, the different issues, the different context, and how we have really been shortchanging Paul. We have truly been treating him one-dimensionally, projecting our Western ways of thinking on the words and issues and phrases that he uses, when they have very, very different contextual meanings in the first century in the city, urban Christianity world. And it's exciting. It's like discovering a whole new world for the first time, even though I've been in the church for 65 years. So for me, that's really exciting, and it's exciting to see the people jaws drop and say, I had no idea. And it turns out that this is a very rich, weighty trip with exciting moments and lots of gravitas. It's the perfect complement to going to Israel.
We're anxious to hear all we can about it. I'm not to take us off course here, but I'm reading a book by Dr. Peter Enns now. It's called The Bible Tells Me So, Why Defending Scripture Has Made Us Unable to Read It. And just to distill a couple of basic points out of it, he spends time in both the Old and the New Testament, but in the Old Testament, he is essentially saying that not only is the context of the content of the books important to us, but so is the context, the historical context of the time of the author. Because many times the author was writing about events that had happened 200 or 300 or 400 years before. And so he may have been writing with purposes other than what we see on the surface. For example, Chronicles, he would maintain, was written to re-inspire and rededicate the Jewish remnant that had come back to Jerusalem after the Babylonian exile. Whereas Kings was written to explain to them how this kingdom of Israel could have been lost and God could have turned his back on them, what they did wrong. And so you see what we see on the surface as contradictions between the two, between Kings and Chronicles, but in fact, they just reflect the different purposes of the authors. But when you get to the New Testament, and this is true in particular of Paul's writings, he was writing at the same time. Those were contemporaneous with the growth of his churches. He was there amongst them writing at the exact same time. So the context then becomes one. In other words, the author's context is not necessarily different from the context of the content. Do you see what I mean?
I sure do. And the point you make is one I'd like to think we make in our Bible Alive teaching weekends, where we develop a framework that you may remember, that you have to deal with the ground level context, you have mm-hmm. to deal with the context that's going on at 5,000 feet, and you have to deal with the 30,000 foot macro context of the scriptures all at the same time. Mm-hmm. And so I agree with ends, you know. What he's making reference to is the 5,000 foot perspective of the author himself looking back over time and maybe recreating and re-emphasizing some themes with a slightly different purpose with the contemporary setting. And we have the same issue with Paul. You know, we've got what's going on at ground level, and then at 5,000 feet, what's going on in the development of the Christian church at the same time.
What kind of, back to Italy for a second, Doug, what kinds of references to Paul do you see on the ground? I mean, it's I guess I'm imagining going to Boston and seeing a sign that Paul Revere's house was here, and John Adams walked these steps while he was going to, you know, plead the case for the soldiers. And are there references to Paul in Italy, in Rome, in these different places?
If you are talking about a reference of something etched in stone, no.
Okay.
But we have to pull on the biblical record, and which tells us where he landed, and we can go to that place and stand within 100 feet of probably where he first landed in Puteoli, which is Puteoli today. The Appian Way is only 12 foot wide, and it runs from Puteoli, the first Appian Way, right up to Rome. And so, you know, if you take a minute and walk back and forth over a 3 foot wide of paving stones on the Appian Way, you can literally say you've walked where Paul's walked. We're pretty well convinced that we know where he was in house arrest, and you can go stand in those rooms. History is pretty solid about where he was beheaded, and so we can stand within 100 feet of where we know he was beheaded. We obviously know where he's buried. That's an actual a large basilica today. So there's some pretty significant indicators, but the biggest indicator is Scripture itself.
Yeah, I guess I was wondering what the local culture has done, what the Italians have done to memorialize Paul, except for the church, of course. But the I guess, you know, he would be a very, very well-known, famous figure in history.
Well, in church circles, but I'm wondering then, outside of the church, was Paul a significant historical figure in Italy? And I'm suspecting not.
To the extent that he's a significant historical figure, we have to credit the historic Roman church for those kinds of things. But, you know, one of the things we'll talk about in future our times together is the very slow...
Oh, watch your button there, Doug. Yep, there you go.
One of the things that we'll talk about is the very slow growth of the early Christian church. You know, by about 100 AD, there probably are not 1,000 Christians in Rome. It doesn't get to 1% of the culture, 1% of the population in Rome until the year 200 AD. Then there's some explosive growth from about 250 on. But yeah, that's a whole nother discussion. I think we just think that Christianity just took off like wildfire in the first century. No, it really didn't. And we can talk about a lot of the dynamics of that in future times. But just to be contemporary with you guys this morning, I'm listening about an hour ago, and you're going through the birthday list. You remember who the first person on your birthday list was?
Well, it wasn't Nietzsche. Let's see. Let me go back to it here.
Virgil.
Yes, Virgil, a Roman historian and author. Yeah.
So I heard that and said, well, we talked about Virgil on our trip.
Happy birthday. Well, we can't sing happy birthday because we have to pay royalties then. So
right. That'll kill charges.
Happy
birthday. You know, he wrote the Aeneid, 12 volumes, and in volume either 6 or 7, he talked about that a king would come from heaven, from the gods, okay, and be a, quote, ruler on earth, unquote, who would be known as, quote, the Prince of Peace, unquote. Yeah, right.
What year was that? What year?
Augustus sort of was the patron of Virgil to write the Aeneid, okay? Mm-hmm. And one would wonder if Virgil put those phrases in there to pander to his patron. But Augustus's sister reads that portion of the Aeneid one day and says, that is being written about Augustus. And so she goes to Augustus and said, here, it's been predicted. You are the one who have come from the gods. And Augustus really liked that idea. So he declared himself divine. And we have the first emperor who claims he's divine. And in the 30s, in Rome, during the Mussolini era, they were digging around and they actually found the remains of what's now known as the Altar of Augustus, which he erected in honor of his own divinity. And why did I just go down this road? Because that's a huge paradigmal backdrop to the Gospels. When Paul shows up one day and says, I want to tell you about a person who came from the gods and came to earth as a person, to be the ruler of all creation, Jesus Christ. And so thanks to Virgil and thanks to Augustus, this notion that a king could come from the gods and come to the earth in the form of a human was a paradigm already in place when Paul brings the gospel about Jesus Christ to the Roman world, and it helped the acceptance of that notion.
It's an amazing story all by itself.
It is, and let's see, where are we here in time? Can I leave you with one more contemporary...
We're easy on time. You do what you would like to do.
Observation here. I want to talk about growth spurts in the early church and epidemics. There were two very significant epidemics in the first 300 years of the church. One in 165 A.D., and one in 251 AD. One is felt to be measles, the other is thought to be chickenpox. And these are not 30-day epidemics, these are like almost decade-long epidemics, okay? And the mortality rate of Romans was 30%.
Wow.
Some say it's higher than that. The mortality rate of Christians was 10%. Why? Because Christians cared for people and Romans didn't. Let me read you something from the first century. This is from Dionysius, one of the early church fathers. When he talked about how the Christians cared for one another, he then writes, the heathen behaved in a very opposite way. At the first onset of the disease, they pushed the sufferers away and fled from their dearest, throwing them into the roads before they were dead, and treated unburied corpses as dirt, hoping thereby to avert the spread and contagion of the fatal disease. But do what they might, they found it difficult to escape its consequences. All right? So medical nursing science tells us that if a person gets sick, if you just provide them with water and food, you'll cut their mortality rate by 2/3. So that's what the Christians did. First off, they took care of their own, okay? Gave them water and kept them fed. And that reduced the mortality rate from 30% to 10%. Furthermore, because these are decade-long epidemics, with each passing month, there are more and more Christians who've survived, who now have the antibodies to this disease, although they didn't know it, okay? And that allowed them to care for Romans who had the plague, which the Christians did. And there you had one of the two most significant growth spurts in the early Christian church, because Christians not only cared for their own, they cared for the Romans, who were discarded by their own culture. And in therein, they cut their mortality rate significantly. And therein, they established relationships with these people who were on the verge of death. And therein, these Romans experienced the care and the love and the nurture of Christians. And guess what? They wanted to then come to the house churches, and they began to hear about the gospel and Jesus Christ. And there were very significant growth spurts in the church because of epidemics. Ring any bells for today?
I was thinking of parallels here. Yes.
Yeah.
As a matter of fact, it does.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, of course, now we're with Ebola, we're dealing with a 70% mortality rate, I'm told.
The mortality rate's a lot higher.
At least in Africa, I think that's the case.
Yeah, there's almost 4,500 deaths so far out of just under 9,000 cases discovered.
But the question would be, with adequate care, would 70% go to 20%? I mean, I don't know the answer to that. But what is interesting here is that somebody's going to have to care for these patients. And what made a remarkable statement to a pagan culture was how Christian cared for pagans when they were on the verge of dying and couldn't care for themselves.
Well, God works in some amazing ways, and that'd be one of them.
Yeah, and that takes us to Monte Cassino and the Benedictine, the founding of the Benedictine order there, where St. Benedict's church is right now. Benedict was one of the first Roman orders, the Roman church. And here's the essence of his view of how to impact the world and spread the faith. And this is going to be a tight paraphrase of Benedict. The church needs to be the church who touches the lives of people. And so he established the Benedictine order to touch the lives of people because he felt that the historic church in the 5th century, 4th, 6th century, was really not doing that. And it's an interesting perspective I've never had before, that all of the orders of the historic Roman church can be seen as protest movements for what they felt the church wasn't doing. And so tie that thought together there. Benedict saying the church has to be the church that touches the lives of people. That's exactly what the early Christians did in the first, second, and third centuries. They touched the lives of pagan people and brought them into the kingdom of God.
And you know, I think of the ascetics in the third and fourth centuries. Those folks who were basically rebelling against the civil government and the church, and going out to find faith on their own. Many of them Christians, not all of them Christians, but many were. And those are the kinds of folks that lived on pillars in the desert, and lived in stone cells in abbeys being formed all over the Middle East and in later years in Europe. It all kind of goes hand in glove. Interesting story, and we're looking forward to much more of this from Doug's second Pauline Studies trip to Italy. Doug, once again, the Senior Teaching Fellow and Executive Director at Preserving Bible Times. I want to let folks know, you may be listening to us on BrokenRoadRadio.com this morning. You know, if you're on Live 365, you might want to check over at BrokenRoadRadio.com. There's a link there to preservingbibletimes.org. One, it's a gorgeous website. You can learn a lot just perusing the pages there. But you can also sign up for that monthly reflection and Doug's new series coming out, and see a wealth of photographs, not only of Italy, but of the Holy Land. Tremendous resource for your church and for your Bible studies and small groups and just for yourself personally and your own scriptural studies, preservingbibletimes.org.
And by the way, if you want to see some great pictures of the Naples Historical Museum, which I just uploaded yesterday, they're on the Preserving Bible Times Facebook page. It's a brand new album, which shows you the mosaic galleries, the fresco galleries, the household galleries that were all taken from the homes in Pompeii and Herculaneum and preserved in this museum.
Yeah, that'd be a treat. Before we go, I wanted to ask you about this Prison Chaplains Fund that you're starting. What's the organization behind that? How's that happening?
You know, that's a 15-minute story.
Oh, is it? Okay.
And I knew if I got into Italy, I'd never get to the Prison Chaplains Fund. So would you mind if we kicked off next week with that?
No, let's do exactly that. We'll do just that. Doug Greenwald, thanks so much. And give Nancy a hug for us. Say hi, and we'll see you next Wednesday.
Thanks, guys. Good to be with you.